I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Brussels-based consultant Robert Palmer works on city change and cultural planning in more than 20 countries. He's learned what it takes to transform cities all over the world from also-rans to standouts. He'll share his lessons for cities today on Smart City. We'll also talk to Robert Atkinson. He is Vice President and Director of the Technology and New Economy Project at the Progressive Policy Institute and was one of the earliest to advance the idea of a new economy. We'll ask Rob whether there was ever anything new about the economy, or if new was simply an illusion. That's today on Smart City. First, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Robert Palmer is an international advisor working in 20 countries on cultural planning and city change. He has helped numerous European cities successfully win the designation of European Capital of Culture, including the unlikely cities of Glasgow and Dublin. He now makes his home in Brussels. Robert, thanks for being our guest today on Smart City.
Pleased to be with you.
You've worked with a number of European cities that have won the designation of European Capital of Culture. What does that designation mean?
Well, this is a special European program which started in 1985. So it's almost 20 years old now, where each year one city in Europe is given a special designation called a Capital of Culture. It's a designation given formally by the European Union. And each city is then free to represent the culture of that city as a kind of platform, and can use also the opportunity to be a kind of transformative moment, a kind of catalyst for city development. I mean, since 1985, each city that has had this title has done something different with it. The scheme started with some of the very large capital cities, such as Athens in Greece in 1985. It then moved to Florence. Cities such as Amsterdam and Berlin, very famous cities, have received the designation. But in the 1990s, the designation moved on to cities which perhaps weren't so well known for their cultural assets. A turning point was Glasgow in 1990. There's been cities like Antwerp, Weimar, Bruges. Next year, the title goes to a city called Lille in the north of France. So these are both large cities and big cities, but cities which obviously are making an important contribution to cultural life in Europe, and cities which deserve an opportunity to show that.
You refer to something called a transformative moment. Robert, how do cities find that moment and then capitalize on it?
Well, one process for city change is very much called triggers. That is to try to identify a catalytic project. These are projects that are usually of significant scale and which are of a level of boldness and imagination that they can act as a catalyst for, but also be a symbol of a city's transformation. I mean, in the case of Glasgow in 1990, it was the city's status as cultural capital of Europe. Sometimes cities use major events or festivals, from the Olympic Games and global summits to big street festivals. Other cities have used triggers in the form of building projects or physical transformations. Cities such as Barcelona, Dublin, Bilbao with the new Guggenheim Museum. Cities which have developed cultural quarters and garden festivals. Yet other cities have used the whole issue of social confidence as the trigger. I mean, imagine the impact of thousands of community projects focused on a city's disadvantaged neighborhoods, or turning the entire city over to young people for 2 weeks. So there are many, many triggers, but unfortunately, cities often wait until they're in a stage of crisis. And this crisis then acts as a catalyst. And many of the UK cities and European cities, Manchester, Birmingham in the UK, Rotterdam, completely destroyed, occurred after the Second World War in the U.S., cities like Detroit, Pittsburgh, Chicago. These are cities which had to reach a crisis point. So these different triggers can either be kind of imposed on a city, although they always have to be, they have to grow from a city, but they can be new events or projects. But sometimes the trigger is caused through reasons that are not of the city's wanting.
You've worked in, you're working now in 20 countries. Which cities stand out for you, Robert, for the improvements that they've made?
Well, what I'm increasingly seeing in cities are the cities which are becoming exciting hotbeds for creativity and innovation. The complete transformation of Barcelona over the last 7 or 8 years. Cities like Marseille in France, I think, are very interesting. In Canada, cities like Vancouver and Montreal. Many Chinese cities, cities even small, relatively small Chinese cities like Macau is a city which has become known for its creative edge. And these are usually cities that it's possible to identify strong visionary individuals who have a real sense of the future of the city. And who, this can be from any sector, from the education sector, from the business sector. And these are also cities where there are strong clusters of creative people and organizations. They also tend to be cities which value outsiders and people who think differently, often cities which are ethnically diverse, and cities that have a strong leadership that shares a certain clarity of purpose and likes to change things. So these appear to be the common characteristics of a city in change or a city which is about to embark on an important change.
You make this point about cities as hotbeds of creative development, but I know you've also said that not all cities can be hotbeds of creative development. So, Robert, what are the alternatives for cities?
Well, cities can more or less determine their own futures. I mean, the one fact about cities is they don't stand still. There are options of development and growth, or indeed decline, and there's often a choice. Some cities are quite content to be dormitory cities for other larger cities, that is, a kind of suburban feel, that are quite happy with the role of simply being the homes for commuter traffic. Other cities view themselves as third-age cities. Other cities have developed a role of being shopping cities, where the entire experience is related to consumption. And other cities, of course, have very much been interested in their role as in terms of innovation and creative development. So cities can decide to a certain extent their own future. What seems to be happening now is that most cities are aspiring or recognize the importance of aspiring to be creative hubs. And that only isn't in relation to fostering a new form of economic prosperity, new technology industries and so on. But these are the cities which have become much more livable. There are cities in which people enjoy living. They enjoy being there. And part of it is this creative edge, this energy, sometimes difficult to capture in terms of its analysis, but you sort of know it when you see it, when you actually go into the city, onto a street, and you feel this real sense of excitement. Those are often the cities which are becoming more livable.
You talk about visionary leadership. To what extent, Robert, is it just a stroke of luck that a city will have in its midst a strong visionary leader?
To a certain extent, it is a stroke of luck, in that for leadership of cities, I mean, the traditional model, particularly a democratic model, it's being challenged a little bit because cities or city governance really can't wait for the attraction of a leader who both has competencies in terms of leadership but also has a sense of vision and future for the city. So it's more important to recognize the leadership of a city is more complex than a simple individual, and that cities are now beginning to embark on a style which I'll call a shared leadership. That is, the official city governance, it could be that the mayor or vice mayors or people who are elected democratically recognize that they can't alone lead the city, and they require this collectivity of different visions and different people. And therefore, they sometimes provide an organizational framework to bring into the fray visionaries from different fields, from the fields of education, from business, from alternative sectors within the community. And it's this collection of individuals who between them are very well networked across the different range of communities in a city that are able to provide the real powerhouse of leadership.
Robert, when you work with cities, do you find yourself working with these shared leadership groups, or who normally brings you in?
It depends from city to city. Sometimes it's a desperate mayor or a city council recognizing that the city isn't particularly well networked, that it's poised for change, and don't quite understand the kind of methods, the methodology, the processes that it needs to go through to make it more cohesive, more challenging, more inventive, more exciting. So that's from an official capacity. Certainly the work I'm doing now in Brussels, the work in Glasgow, the work in Barcelona is from the top in that way, the officialdom. But very often it's by one of the fragmented groups within the city. Sometimes it's the city's artistic community. Sometimes it's the business community. There's two occasions where I've been asked to work with some of the city's festivals in order to create something which is bigger than these individual initiatives. And then I embark on a process which I sometimes call cultural planning, which is a process that starts with a very broad understanding of cultural resources and assets of the city, but begins to develop new alliances and networks. Because the view I now hold, again based on my experience, is that the most successful cities are the ones that are managed by a process that is very distributed and decentralized rather than centralized. A city which can bridge many divisions and differences, a city which perhaps has many individual dots, energy points, but are really wanting to foster the connections between the dots, interlinked networks. And this, I think, is a process which can start anywhere in a city.
You're listening to Smart City. We're talking today with Robert Palmer. He's an international advisor working in 20 countries on city change and cultural planning. Robert, you've said a couple of things I want to pursue. One is this issue of cultural planning. Often we think of cultural planning as we're planning an arts district, or we're planning a way to fund the existing arts group. You're really talking about cultural planning as something much bigger, it seems to me. Describe it a little bit more.
Cultural planning is not a thing. It's a process. And it starts with a very broad understanding of what I'll call the cultural assets of a city, the raw materials, which means not just looking at a theater or a group of orchestras or art galleries or even a part of the city, but it's able to look at a vast collection of people, artists, creators, organizations, groups, facilities, buildings, both the hardware and the software. And I'm not only talking here about traditional creative industries such as music making or publishing or architecture, and I'm not talking here only about social and economic impacts of culture, but viewing the cultural planning process as one which can identify and mobilize what I'll call a city's creative capital or imagination capital. The ability of a city to generate new ideas. This is a city that is trying to foster enterprise and confidence. So cultural planning is a process where the imaginative and the functional can fuse. And this process has to adopt a horizontal perspective. rather than cities often working vertically in terms of an education policy and a housing policy and a transportation policy and a city physical planning policy, to view culture or the contribution of culture to economic prosperity, to social inclusion, to ethnic diversity, to environmental sustainability, to civic engagement, but not lose the sense of the value of culture as a force that binds people together. So cultural planning is a process that fosters the celebration of the creative spirit in each of us.
Robert, you mentioned you're working in Barcelona. Talk about your work there.
Well, Barcelona is a city which has undergone several transformations. It hit a very tricky period, just following the overthrow of Franco, where the city lacked pride in itself. Now people view Barcelona as an extremely beautiful city, a city which is full of creative energy. But it wasn't always like that. This energy was locked in. And the city used the opportunity of hosting the Olympics in 1992 as an event in order to catalyze the energies within the city, but at the same time undergo a major process of physical change. And they did this on the basis of neighborhoods, whereas most cities are planning centrally. This was organized on a very decentralized, distributed basis by many, many individual local communities working with architects, artists, children, priests, political figures, teachers, all of whom gathered together in individual communities and began to look at this whole issue of physical transformation and also the issue of community building. And as I mentioned before, this question of joining the dots, these were developing very powerful nodes, energetic nodes, and then the plan, the process was connecting these dots. Now the city is moving through the next phase of cultural planning, the new process of cultural planning in Barcelona. The aim is to generate ideas which will feed into the overall experience of the city. Roger Sperry, who is a neurologist, points out how ideas help to evolve new ideas. That is, they interact with each other and with mental forces in the same brain and neighboring brains. And this is how a city like Barcelona should operate during a cultural planning process. Fertile ideas take root and spread seeds. Ideas are then tied together and they form bridges between one intelligence and another and provide a common point of reference. And this common point of reference is called a cultural plan. So Barcelona is moving through this process. And processes are about people and ways of connecting people together.
Robert, what's the toughest city you've ever worked in?
Well, I think the current city I work in, which is Brussels, is really a mind-blowing city. I mean, imagine this. It's a city with a population of about 1 million. There are 19 independently elected mayors in this city with 19 independent administrative units. If that weren't enough, there are three official languages, French, Flemish, and German, and six strong political parties. So everything is done through a coalition. So you end up with this incredible matrix between language, administrative unit, political orientation, and so on, which makes the city exceedingly dysfunctional in terms of a traditional leadership model for cities. And therefore, the challenge here has been to try to get people to recognize a common vision and then very simply to work together. And that has taken many years to achieve.
Where do you start in a city that is that politically complicated?
I always start by using a principle of the path of least resistance. That is, I identify people who actually want to work together. Sometimes they are visionary leaders, sometimes they are not. Sometimes they are individuals who are stuck in the middle of a city governance program. And these are the people, they are the right people to start with, because you then form a kind of new DNA for the city by connecting that group. And this then forms an important cluster which can act as a magnet for others to join. So in Brussels, I found it was largely the city's artistic community. And this group of people worked across languages, across the geography of the city, across ages, and created an interesting powerhouse, a sort of motor for development. And it was the politicians and city planners that came on board much, much later.
Robert, given all the cities you've worked in, if you could summarize the three or four or five points, perhaps, that lessons you've learned that cities can take those lessons and begin their own process of transformation, what would those things be? What would those that wisdom consist of?
There have been a number of common factors. I mean, unfortunately, cities have focused too uniquely on what is often called their economic prosperity. And I think now what's required is a much more holistic approach, which combines economic prosperity with the city's social prosperity, its environmental prosperity, and its cultural prosperity. So this is a kind of whole systems approach to thinking about cities. I sometimes call it the cultural ecosystem of a city, working horizontally, trying to combine these different factors. Cities that are able to challenge assumptions. Sometimes they are challenging parts of their own history. Cities that are very receptive to new ideas. Become very important assets. Cities which are trying to celebrate their real difference to other cities. So often I find cities that want to be like other cities. I think that's the wrong direction to move in. So it's the celebration, first of all, the recognition and celebration of that real uniqueness and to try to focus on that particular quality. Cities which are trying to make unlikely connections. That is where different communities of interest are combining in very unlikely combinations. And these are often cities that enjoy taking advantage of the unexpected, enjoy taking risks, enjoy taking chances. And finally, cities which really view themselves as learning cities. That is, cities that value the process of sharing ideas and that have created frameworks and a cultural context that promote regular exchanges of information, people really enjoying working with one another. It's those characteristics which I found to be the ones that are most central to a successful city.
Robert, thanks so much for being our guest today on Smart City.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Robert Palmer is a Brussels-based international consultant. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Robert Atkinson about the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Robert Atkinson is Vice President of the Progressive Policy Institute and Director of the Institute's Technology and New Economy Project, where he was the lead author of the New Economy Index and the State New Economy Index. Dr. Atkinson was also a project director at the former Congressional Office of Technology Assessment. While at OTA, he directed the Technological Reshaping of Metropolitan America, a report examining the impact of the information technology revolution on America's urban areas. Rob, thanks for being our guest today on Smart City.
Thank you.
How do you define the new economy?
Well, I'll tell you how I don't define it. First, I don't define it as I think too many people do, as an economy that is all about computers and the internet and Silicon Valley. That's a very narrow and I think misleading approach to the new economy. The new economy, rather, is a set of more fundamental and basic structural transformations that have the economy's undergone in the last 15 years or so. It's a more global economy. New economy is a more information and knowledge intensive economy. It's a more competitive and entrepreneurial economy. And finally, it's an economy that is certainly more technology driven. But you have to put all of those factors together to really understand it, I would argue.
And with the decline in the economy over the last few months, you still believe in the new economy?
I do. And I believe in it as strongly, if not more, than I did two or three years ago. But that's because I never bought into the hype that some people use to describe the new economy as the greatest thing since the Industrial Revolution and phrases like that. It never was that. What it was a kind of transformation that the U.S. economy seems to undergo about every 50 years or so. We underwent something similar back in the 1890s and early first decade of the 1900s, and again in the 1940s and 50s, we seem to evolve into a different type of economic system, and that's really where we are today. Why I'm actually pretty positive about it is if you look at, I think, the most important number in terms of assessing how well our economy is going, and that's productivity growth. We actually had the highest productivity growth we've had in over 40 years last year. So we certainly have big problems now in the economy in terms of overall demand and job growth. But looking at productivity growth, we're doing quite well, and I think that's largely because of these new economy forces.
Rob, you've written that neither conservatives nor liberals have focused on the right aspect of economic policy, which you say is productivity.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's sort of in a perverse way, both conservatives and liberals want to take the easy way out, which is redistribution. You know, a lot of what the Bush approach is about is saying, well, if we're not boosting incomes all that much, we'll just cut taxes, and therefore Americans' after-tax income will go up. And conversely, some liberal Democrats say, well, the best way to help workers is redistribution. We'll raise the minimum wage, or we'll extend various kinds of social benefits to workers. Those are maybe good things to do, but the only way we're really going to boost incomes in this country for the vast majority of Americans, and that's to boost the underlying productive potential of our economy. And we saw that in the 90s. For most of the 1980s and early 90s, we saw pretty anemic wage growth. American wages grew only about 6% in a 10-year period, and that's because productivity didn't grow. But then really in the middle and late years of the Clinton administration, we saw very robust wage growth up to 2 and 3% per year. And that's because productivity finally started to grow again.
And productivity grows because of what?
Well, let me define what productivity is, first of all, and it's a pretty simple measure. It's how much output a worker produces in an hour of work or a day of work. And what we all consume, the goods and the services we consume, are largely dependent upon how much it is that we can produce, and that's dependent on productivity. It goes up. Most economists would agree that most of the increase we have in productivity comes from a pretty simple factor, and that's new technology. So, for example, I used to pay my bills by writing a check. And I would put it in the envelope and I'd mail it. And the company that got it had to pay somebody to open my envelope and read the check and mark it into their computer and send it to the bank. And that whole process cost about $1, $1.10. Well, now what I do is as about 30 million other Americans, I pay my bills using the internet. And that costs about 5 or 6 cents. By doing that, I have boosted the productivity of the economy. We produce more goods and services now with a lot less cost. So that's really the way we boost productivity. That's the principal way, is new technology.
Other ways?
Well, the other principal way is our higher skills. So, for example, pretty clear evidence that if a company spends money to increase the skills of its workforce, it will make that up through higher productivity. So about, depending on what studies you look at, between probably 20 to 30% of our increase in productivity is through higher skills, and 60 to 70% is through new technology.
Rob, you've spent some time trying to measure the new economy and its robustness in terms of states. Which states are performing well in the new economy, which ones are not? What indicators do you use to measure performance?
We're pretty careful about trying to use a broad array of measures because, as I said before, we don't believe that the new economy is simply just about IT, information technology jobs, as some groups have tried to measure. Rather, we look at an array of 5 different types of indicators. The report we recently did called the 2002 State New Economy Index, we used 21 indicators. In 5 categories. One category were knowledge jobs. So, for example, we looked at how many managerial, professional, and technical jobs the state had. We also looked at globalization, We also looked at entrepreneurial dynamism. In other words, it turns out one of the really big drivers of a state economy is just how entrepreneurial it is. The fourth thing we looked at was information technology usage. So are there companies that are using information technology to become more productive? And finally, technology innovation. Are there companies that are developing patents? Are they hiring lots of scientists and engineers, that sort of thing?
You mentioned entrepreneurial activity as being a big driver in terms of performance in the new economy. Rob, what underlies entrepreneurial activity? What drives it, and how can you get more of it?
That's a tough question that I don't think people have a clear answer on what drives it. I think there are a few things that drive it. I think one of the central things that drives it is demographics. If you have a population in your state or your metropolitan area that tend to be more educated, that tend to be more mobile, they will be more entrepreneurial than people who are less educated and less mobile. They just have the ability to take their ideas, they have better networks, and they're able to translate those ideas into new companies. So that's part of it. The other part of it, I think, is really a culture. If you look at places that have high levels of entrepreneurialism, the culture there is really about risk-taking. And it's about building networks with other companies and knowing venture capitalists and knowing who to bring into your company to help you market or help you find develop new products. That's different than in some other parts of the country. Some parts of the country, the culture is much more about stability, about not taking risks, about taking out debt loans as opposed to venture capital. So I think a lot of what places can do is to really work hard at identifying their overall business culture and how they might move it toward to be more entrepreneurial.
Rob, you were one of the first to write in depth about the new economy. When you look back on what you wrote in 1998 about the new economy, what did you get right and what do you think you got wrong?
The parts that I think we got right were our focus on that it's this broader piece, that it's not just, as I said, and I hate the term, if people use it, oh, we're going to focus on new economy industries. We've argued all along there is no such thing as a new economy industry. There are things such as new economy firms and old economy firms. For example, you might have argued that Wang Computer was an old economy company, even though they were in the computer business because they were focused on old technology. One could just as easily argue that a farmer in South Dakota who's using the internet to sell or buy their crops or their seeds and is using bioengineered products and has a satellite GPS system on their tractor, that's a new economy farmer. So I think that's one of the main things we got right, is that the new economy is much more than just simply a small set of sort of technology indicators. In terms of what we got wrong, probably the one thing I'd say we maybe were a little over-optimistic on was the growth of technology jobs. I'm not saying that is not going to happen, but if you look at technology jobs there certainly we have more technology jobs in the economy today than we did in, say, 1999, but we have fewer than we did in 2000. So I think that there's a good chance that technology jobs will come back quite strongly, but that certainly isn't happening right now.
You're listening to Smart City. We're talking today with Rob Atkinson. He is Vice President and Director of the Technology and New Economy Project for the Progressive Policy Institute. Rob, what do you conclude when you look at the recent job losses in cities like San Francisco, San Jose, Austin, Texas, which has been a real star? They're sort of wringing their hands about it. We need a new economic development strategies. Those are cities that performed, of course, very well on your new economy indexes. Are they also more vulnerable to economic volatility and layoffs?
There's a big debate, a long-standing debate in the economic development world about whether it's better to be specialized if you're a city or a region, or whether it's better to be diversified. And I think the debate is somewhat similar to thinking about ownership of stocks as an individual. There appears to be evidence that if you're a city or a region and you're specialized, that you get more on the upside. In other words, when the economy is growing and you do better, but that you have a higher risk on the downside. So I guess the question really is sort of how much risk are places comfortable with? If you aren't comfortable with risk and loss, then it's better to be diversified. But if you want to be specialized, like Austin was, or Silicon Valley, or Route 128 in Boston, you get a lot of the upside gains. They had enormous income growth and job growth in the 90s, much faster than most other regions of the country. But now, obviously, they're hurting. I think the important thing to recognize, though, with regions that have focused, specialized on tech, and particularly IT, is that the IT economy is a cyclical economy. It's been through this before. We went through a slowdown in the 84, 85 period. We went through another very significant slowdown in 90 and 91. And each time we've emerged, the IT economy has emerged from these slowdowns, they've emerged in a stronger position. If I had to pick between being right now in Silicon Valley for the next decade, who would do better, them or, let's say, a region that hasn't as much assets in technology, I would pick Silicon Valley every day.
You've said consistently, and others have said consistently, that quality of life really matters in the new economy. First of all, let me clarify, when you say quality of life, what do you really mean?
What I really mean is some kind of assets that a place has that make it attractive for what are called knowledge workers to move there. Turns out the people who tend to move most are the people that tend to have a college degree, largely because they have more job security. They can go around and find jobs. Those are actually, I think, the almost as big a drivers now of growth for a region as the ability to attract companies. So if you can attract knowledge workers, people who have the ability to work in high-wage jobs, people who have the ability to contribute in entrepreneurial ventures, you'll do quite well. Question is, why do they go to places? What attracts them to places? Well, it turns out it's two things. Are there good job opportunities there? But the other is quality of life. And those can take the form of everything from a good school system to good outdoor recreation, bike paths, kayaking, nice urban amenities. It's various places will have different amenities and different specialties. But the real key, I think, the key lesson here is that we can no longer say that quality of life and the arts and public services and the rest are sort of peripheral or secondary to our real goal, which is getting a good business climate or cutting taxes or something like that. That just doesn't work anymore. So we have to think now about quality of life as a key driver.
Rob, if you're a decision maker running a city, even a state, but let's stick with the city, you're having to make decisions about investing in this asset versus that asset. I mean, generally, you don't have enough money to do everything you'd like to do. So, when you think about quality of life from a decision maker standpoint and an investment strategy, where would you be looking to make the best investment? What would be the things that would point you to the best investment you could make in quality of life?
If I were a mayor or a head of a county council, I'd really do two things. One is I would do everything possible to make my local government, incredibly efficient. And so I would find ways, particularly to use technology, to drive down costs and improve the quality of city services. That in and of itself will make a place more attractive. One of the things I think that makes places unattractive is when people feel that really the city is all about machine politics or inept bureaucracies that really don't provide the quality that taxpayers deserve for the dollar they're paying. So that's number one. Number two is then you say, well, what would we do with those savings? How would we invest them? And again, that depends. But I guess my view would be, I think depending on the type of city, that investments in really making the urban life more vibrant and vital have a good payoff. When I was head of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council, I thought one of the best things that the city of Providence did was a whole redevelopment of their river. Essentially, it was just an old sort of almost industrial riverfront, and they redeveloped it, and it's a wonderful, wonderful place now. And they have art festivals and this river fire and museums, and it's just a great place, and it makes the not just the city but the entire region a more attractive and vibrant place. So I think efforts to do urban revitalization and the new urbanism have a lot to say for them.
Rob, there are cities that clearly are getting left behind in the new economy. What do those cities have in common?
there's different types of groups of places that are getting left behind. Well, one place are the more remote small towns that aren't close to airports. They're not close to other job sites. Those are going to be tough places to do well. And I think in some ways, maybe not a lot we can do about those. Then there are bigger metropolitan areas or cities that aren't doing well. They tend to have a couple of things in common. One is weather. As a general rule, places in the Sun Belt and the South and the West are doing better than places in the North. And that's partly because people vote with their feet and like living in warmer climates. I think the other thing that places that aren't doing well have in common is they have a legacy of sort of an older industrial base. You know, in some ways, it's easy for a place like Research Triangle Park or Seattle or San Francisco to do well because they're not having to start over. They're not having to sort of bulldoze what they've done and start over. They're starting afresh. And it's harder to do that in a place like Pittsburgh or Cleveland or Buffalo, where you really have long legacy traditions and infrastructure and worker skills and attitudes. And that's hard to change in any kind of short term.
You've suggested that some places, Rob, should be satisfied with getting smaller, that their focus should be on boosting incomes and creating better jobs for their citizens. But in this new economy, if your starting point is an undereducated population, then where is the foundation for the new economy if, in fact, you're not growing?
Actually, what I think I said was that places don't necessarily need to focus on growing, that stability might be an okay path for many places as long as incomes are growing. And it turns out my co-author on a report we did, the Metropolitan New Economy Index, Paul Gottlieb, who's a professor now at Princeton, he did a study and he found out that there are lots of places in the 90s that grew in income but didn't grow in population. Buffalo, New York is one of those that I remember. And I'm not sure what's wrong with that. Maybe they want to grow more. But for many, many metropolitan areas, the problem is not growing jobs. The problem is, frankly, problems stemming from too much growth. And you'll just look at Washington, D.C., where I am, or Silicon Valley, or Los Angeles, or New York, where housing prices are, frankly, out of reach for most workers. You have big problems with traffic congestion and air quality. It's not at all clear to me why we should be, as local economic developers in these areas, why you would want to push for even more growth. It doesn't seem like it gets very many benefits for the actual people who are living there. I think a better strategy, for most places would be to say, we're going to focus on raising incomes. We're going to focus on trying to get better jobs. Now, how do you do that if you have a community with where there's lower education levels? Well, it turns out that, again, Paul Gottlieb did a study on this, that there's a strong correlation between income growth in metropolitan areas and education levels. Not too surprising that if your metropolitan area has more educated people, their incomes were more likely to grow in the 1990s. But again, I think there are things that places can do, particularly with working with companies to help them adopt and develop skills training programs so that the workers who are already in a community can improve their skills. Certainly, radical education reform, really transforming public schools so that they're effective, can play an important role as well. So I don't think places have to give up. But I do think that if they're going to succeed, then institutional change of a pretty significant kind is what's going to be needed.
Last year, you advocated the creation of a national skills corporation. Is that part of the education transformation you're talking about?
It is. And the reason we did that is because we believe that if you're really talking about an economy in which the number one factor determining success is knowledge, and I don't just mean skills, but knowledge and innovation and the ability to conceptualize new ideas and carry them out, then we need to make a much more significant commitment to that as a nation. And one of the ways we need to do it is we need to work in partnership with companies and groups of companies and where appropriate, unions who are already trying to work to improve the skills of their workers, but oftentimes don't do it anymore that much because it used to be if you gave your workers skills, they might stay at the company for 10 years and you would get a good payoff from that. But now, when the average job tenure is less than 4 years, companies don't have a lot of incentive to really invest in the skills anymore. So what we proposed is a national corporation, a nonprofit, quasi-governmental corporation governed by business leaders and labor leaders and local government officials to co-invest with industry in these types of skills alliances.
Rob, you were an economic development official at the state level. Have our local and state economic development strategies caught up to the new economy?
I would say they're catching up. I don't think they've caught up.
Where's the biggest disconnect?
I think the biggest disconnect is on the notion of what drives growth. There's really been a 40 or almost 50-year legacy of a very strong belief that the way you get growth is you cut costs for business. It's really all about a cost model. You know, you hear these phrases of so-and-so place is open for business, or we've got the best business climate. And what they really mean by that is we've got the lowest cost for business. That actually might have made some sense 30 years ago or even 20 years ago when most business location decisions were cost-based. But in a more entrepreneurial, knowledge, and technology-driven economy, companies who are focused principally on cost probably aren't going to be in this country. They're going to be in Mexico, or they're going to be in developing nations overseas. So what really drives growth here is not you have the lowest cost, but you have the highest quality. And so that means you have a good infrastructure. Do you have good, high-quality, highly skilled workers? Do you have a good research base? So if community colleges and universities that are aligned with the type of companies you have in a region. So I think that's the biggest and hardest change for a lot of economic developers to really come to grips with and understand.
Rob, thanks for being our guest today on Smart City.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Robert Atkinson is Vice President of the Progressive Policy Institute. I'm Carol Collette, and you're listening to Smart City. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says in life, it's hard to find the right balance of what we can't live with and what we can't live without.
There is an old trick that revolutionary movements have used for centuries to topple the regimes they oppose. The trick is to provoke the establishment into overreacting to revolutionary provocations, because an excessive reaction often galvanizes broader resistance by undermining the moral authority of the established order. Sometimes this trick works just by accident. For example, when Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and the Washington Post in 1971, he was just trying to get the facts about the war into the public domain. He wasn't trying to provoke the Nixon administration into overreacting, but that's exactly what happened. President Nixon responded by setting up the infamous White House plumbers to plug information leaks. But in their zeal, the plumbers did many questionable things, including bugging the offices of the Democratic Party, a bit of political espionage that led directly to Watergate and the eventual resignation of President Nixon. Many revolutionaries would contend that it is only in response to extreme provocations that the true nature of a regime is revealed. And perhaps there is some truth in this notion, for only in trying times do we see which liberties are considered so precious that they are untouchable even when things are at their worst. Of course, revolutionary movements have the advantage of not having to govern, so they aren't saddled with the burden of keeping order while responding to threats and dangers. Indeed, revolutionaries can use both the freedoms and the restrictions of government to their advantage. They can use the freedoms to move about and sow dissent, and then later trumpet their "I told you so's" when the government decides to crack down with restrictions and force. Responding to provocations can be a tough dilemma. We even wrestle with this sort of choice between bad and worse in our personal lives. We know that our children are going to misbehave, yet we are not going to fence them in like cattle. We know that a few employees and coworkers will flaunt company policies, yet we don't want to lose contributing team members just for the sake of protocol. We know that some people make a point of speeding, breaking in line, or talking out of turn, Yet we also know that the only ways to stop them are unacceptably intrusive and domineering. In every aspect of our lives, we know how hard it is to find the right balance of what we can't live with and what we can't live without. Politically, this quandary is felt most keenly in democracies. No society can tolerate violence and discord. Yet in a democracy, a repressive response is nothing but a Pyrrhic victory. Because when democracies respond to threats against the social order in ways that impinge upon fundamental rights, liberties, and freedoms, the essence of democracy itself is jeopardized. Something elemental is lost. Something essential to the very definition of democratic society is sacrificed. The enemies of democracy win at least a small victory at home, if not a much bigger victory in the court of world opinion, by being able to claim that when push comes to shove, democracies are, in truth, no better than the most despotic dictatorships. Recent events have put America in exactly this situation. Fundamental extremists who believe that American values are sinful and corrupt pose a threat to the safety and well-being of American citizens, forcing us to ask ourselves how much we are willing to curtail certain rights and liberties in order to increase our vigilance and security. Over the past 2 years, we have learned that there are no easy answers to this question. But there are better and worse ways to think about what we must do and how we should proceed. Broadly speaking, we must guard against overreaction, for this is exactly the response that our enemies are hoping to provoke. As we move security to the top of our priority list, we must make it stand alongside liberty, not displace it. We must show that in a democracy, it is possible to balance the competing needs of safety and freedom. We must show that in a democracy, unlike an authoritarian fundamentalist state, we always try to do more than simply call upon our reserves of power and force. The strength of the American character is as much a strong heart as an iron fist. A balanced response will show that America is willing and able to do the hardest thing of all, keeping our society free, even as we keep it safe.
For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.